So I work at Saclay in Paris, and for those of you who don't know me, and I also have a fellowship from the National Science to do research there in Saclay. So the topic of my talk will be molecular dynamics and using molecular dynamics for dynamic fracture and also studying plasticity in amorphous silica. So these are my collaborators. The fracture simulations were done with Rajiv Kalia at CAX, and the analysis after the fracture simulations, a bunch of it has been done with the group at Saclay at the Synergy Energy Atomic, and then the plasticity work that I'm doing is with the group at Saint-Gobain. So some of the critical issues in dynamic fracture are how are atoms bonds breaking, how are atoms rearranging, and then the dissipation of energy ahead of the crack front, and the scaling properties of the fracture surfaces after their cracks. We see here, and there's some universal exponents associated with those. And these issues are all very well investigated with molecular dynamics techniques. So this is the outline of my talk. I'll first tell you about the molecular dynamics simulation methodology and the potential that I use, and then how we've validated the potential and the fracture results on amorphous in comparison with experiments. Then I'll show you some of the beginnings of the works that I'm doing in irreversible deformation using densification and shear, and then a few concluding remarks on silica. So first of all, molecular dynamics uses Newton's equation, which is force equals mass times acceleration, and the important ingredient is the interatomic potential. I use the interatomic potential developed by Vashista and his colleagues. This is it's a two-body and three-body potential. The two-body is a steric repulsion, screen Coulomb, and charged dipole term. And the three-body consists of a covalent bond bending and bond stretching term. So in order to prepare silica, we have to heat the system up. And here you can see, this is beta cristobalite. We put our atoms in the initial position of beta cristobalite. And the yellow is silicon, the orange is oxygen. So the density of this is 2.2 grams per cc, which is the same density of the final silica. So we heat the system up to 3,200 degrees Kelvin, stabilize, reduce it down in a stepwise process to approximately 0 degrees Kelvin, and then run a conjugate gradient and heat it back up to 300 degrees Kelvin where we do our simulations. So the potentials that we use, this is the neutron scattering structure factor data. You can see the yellow is neutron data and the green is the MD results. And if you take the Fourier transform, you can get the neutron scattering paracorrelation function. And you can see they agree quite favorably. And using Wright's Rx factor, you can see there's only about a 4.4% difference in the two. No, it was fit to the amorphous system. You have to use the crystalline structure to build the amorphous system, because you have to have initial positions of the atoms, and you don't know the initial positions, so that's why we have to
use the same potential for the crystalline state.
It's not very good for the crystalline state, this potential. It's very good for the amorphous, but it's not the best for the crystalline. There's other potentials that are better for the crystalline state.
So what sorts of things have to be changed? Or is there something systematic?
I don't know. I know it's not. It doesn't define the crystal structure very well. I don't remember that. I know it's very good for the amorphous system. So you can see the elastic. We look at the elastic constants, the moduli, and the Poisson ratio. The elastic constants for simulation and experiments, you can see they agree quite favorably. Also, the if you take the elastic cross stitch, you can calculate the shear, young, and bulk modulus, and they agree favorably. And the Poisson ratios also agree favorably. So in order to do the fracture simulation, what we do is, once we have our bulk system, we insert a notch, we remove the periodic boundary conditions in the X, Y, at least. Some of the simulations, I also removed the periodic boundary conditions in the Z direction if the simulation was big enough.
Sorry.
The Z would be out of the board. X is the direction of propagation, and Y is the direction of displacement. So you have this frozen boundary, and then you displace this in a systematic way. So you displace it, let the system stabilize, displace it, and let the system stabilize, and this will cause the crack to propagate in the what I call the X direction. So, for example, this is a 15 million atom simulation. This simulation, there was periodic Milner conditions out of the board. So this is 120 nanometers by 120 nanometers and 15 nanometers out of the board. This is just the atoms.
But you said, so in your third direction you had a periodic boundary condition?
Right.
So is stress control to be zero, or the volume control to be zero?
Or the period.
Yeah. The volume is controlled to be zero. The volume is not allowed to change. So here you can see that the pores are opening up ahead of the crack front. So here's the initial notch, and there's a little bit of, it's already started to propagate in this movie. And you can see that the pores, there's pores growing ahead of the crack front and merging with the crack tip. This movie is about about 75 picoseconds, if I remember correctly. It's about the Rayleigh speed. Yeah. About half the Rayleigh speed, not the Rayleigh speed. They are allowed to bounce off if there's any waves in the system.
So it's actually more or less in equilibrium with the sound waves of the bouncing off.
Yeah. Well, it can separate. I mean, you can get pieces coming off. Because I don't control it, it must be on the surface.
But the sound wave, I don't think the sound wave has the time to go to the boundary and come back before the crack.
Yeah, the... It shouldn't be affecting. We determine there are waves that can propagate, but it's not affecting the crack tip at the current position. It's affecting it. So it.
Oh yeah, it's moving. The puffing, it's
yeah. Still, yeah. This is for the larger system. We had a 1200 by 1200 by 1200 angstroms. So the only difference in the other from the simulation to the previous simulation is the width is longer. And here you can see, initially the crack doesn't propagate, and the velocity here is, the initial velocity is about 400 meters per second, and then in this region you have about 1300 meters per second. And the velocity gets a little faster. And this is the movement of the crack front. Here you can see, initially, again, it's moving slowly. The way I got this picture was I used percolation theory to mesh the system up and looking to see if voxels are empty or full, and used a version of that to determine how where the crack front is.
So if you have a void ahead of the crack, but you have some bonds left in a void ahead, you would...
That would be a pore.
Okay.
if you have bonds, if the crack front, if there's bonds between, so if you have a system like this and it's meshed, like this, and say there's a pore out here. Well, that's it doesn't. If the crack tip's back here, these would be full, and this would be considered a pore out here. And not the crack tip. No, the crack tip is separate.
The connected part without any.
It's the boundary between the, this may be connected still by material between the two slices, but there's still a way for the crack tip to be not connected. It's where the material is fully connected after, except there may be a pore ahead of it. So, in this region, you can see it's moving faster. In the slow region, we found that the cracked tip can move forwards and backwards. So you could see the effects of the healing of the material. And then in the fast region, you see the cracked tip predominantly moving forward. You don't see much backwards movement. And I have more results on those. I haven't presented them. If you want to see them later, I can show them. This is the movie of the pores. So here is the size of the voxel. So a voxel is 4.5 angstroms cubed, so one of these little blocks. And here you can see this white is a crack tip, and you can see all the pores in this region down at the bottom. It may be hard to see. You can see that pores are growing in size and merging with other pores, and also growing, they grow and get bigger, merge, and then they eventually merge with the crack tip. And this seems to be. Yeah, you can see this is also, some of this is also some thermal fluctuations going on in the silica, because you have rings and they can.
Yes, so if you didn't have the crack propagation, but with this temperature, you'd see some of this happening.
Yeah, the voxels are very small, because you can get large rings, and if the rings in the silica are large enough, it could cause. Yeah, there's some fluctuation. Yeah, the predominant pores are in this region, very close to the crack tip, about 10 nanometers. And I'll show some more ahead in the next couple of slides. But first I wanted to talk about some of the experimental results. And so they use in experiments a DC-DC double cleavage drill compression. And here you see the hole, and they initially put a notch. And they scan continuously where near the crack tip of the crack, and this gives them the topography of the fracture of this free surface near the crack tip. So this is the crack here is moving about 3 × 10⁻¹⁰ meters per second, and this is a stress corrosion regime. Here we see again the a color bar, that this one corresponds to the height of the free surface, and the green is a depression and the pink is a heel. Then I'll let it go back over. So here we can see the initial notch that's coming into the screen, and here is a pore opening up, and then they will merge with one another and cause fracture in this region of the sample.
There's no independent stratification that's happening on the edge.
You mean what's happening on the free surface is what's happening in the bulk? We have some, from simulations, we've been able to see that there is some relevance in this region, and I'll get to those results in a few minutes. So next, what they do is they take one image of the topography of the free surface, and they use linear elasticity. So there's linear elasticity says the height of this surface is proportional to 1 over the square root of r, where r is the distance from the crack tip. So you find your crack tip, which is right in here, and you look at a line along the crack tip. So in the x direction, you can plot the height of the fracture surface versus the distance from the crack tip. And if we put it in log-log, you can see there's the red is the line of linear elasticity. You can see there's a departure from linear elasticity about 80 nanometers from the crack tip. Similarly, we can do this in the y. And so z is the height again, and y is the distance from the crack tip. If we put it in log-log, again, the red is the linear elasticity, and you can see there's a departure about 20 nanometers from the crack tip. This is experiments. And I'll show you the simulation results that are also very similar to that in a few minutes in the next slide. So there's a departure from linear elasticity within a process zone of 20 nanometers to 80 nanometers. So in this region here. So next we looked, because I had the free surface in my bulk sample, I was able to look at that, the same thing, and we see that this is the color bar just describing the height of the fracture surface. If we look at a line along the red, we can see that there is again a departure from linear elasticity. The red line here is the linear elasticity, and it's about 10 nanometers from the, there's a departure about 10 nanometers from the crack tip. And in the y direction, there's also a departure about 10 nanometers from the crack tip. Excuse me? This is when the crack tip is moving at about 300 meters per second.
So is that change over the
time? Well, if when the crack tip is moving at approximately 0 meters per second is different. Whenever it's moving at 300 meters per second, it's a different value. And then at 1300 meters per second, it's past, which I'll show you, is past the extent of the damage zone is past the length of the box, so I can't make any conclusive statements about how large the process zone is there. Right, I saw a small one, and it's actually this right here, if you look at it, and this one, they're a little bit smaller. They're about 7 nanometers, if I remember correctly. So they're, it's a slight bit different. So we were interested in what was happening in the bulk, as you asked just a few minutes. X is the direction of propagation. So Y is the direction of pooling. This one is Y, and this one up here is X.
So now you're sort of changing. So now you're stress-free. And this is free surface.
Yeah, this is free surface. And so the next thing we did was we looked at the volume of the pores ahead of the crack front in this block divided by the volume of this total block, atoms plus pores.
And this is how big in the z direction?
In the z direction, so out of the board,
yeah.
It's 1200 nanometers. Yeah.
1200.
Sorry, 1200 angstrom.
Okay.
I'm getting I'm sorry. Mechanical engineers want nanometers, and people from simulations want angstroms. I'm kidding. Sorry. So what I did was I took the volume of the pores in this region divided by the total volume, atoms plus pores in this region. Then I increased this region by a little bit and did the process again. What it does is that gives me the density, the porosity falling off as 1 over R when no more when the volume of the pores is no more significantly being added. So here we see R, the distance from the crack front, and the porosity. You can see there's a peak around 10 nanometers. But what we did was we put it in a log-log plot so that we could see the 1 over R tendency more clearly. And here you can see it's falling off as 1 over R, and this is the 1 over R bar to show you the reference frame. And this is around 10 nanometers, which corresponds to the distance that we saw in the previous slide for the process zone. So we're seeing a zone of damage within the bulk that corresponds to the process zone that's seen on the surface. I'm making it so here is the first one, and then the next one is just a little bit added, a little bit of the distance delta R added to the initial box. So that what that does is it gives me the volume of the pores divided by a constant times a constant times R.
So if you assume that all the porosity is
if everything was if the volume of the pores, if there was no pores, it should all fall off as 1 over R here, but it doesn't. You can see that there's a volume of, there's pores being added to about 10 nanometers, opening up to about 10 nanometers from the crack tip. Yeah, well, I took that into consideration when I was doing the averaging that the crack front wasn't straight.
No, but if you have to go to something, what would you mean? You know,
what's the RMS?
You mean the shape of the crack front? It's more like a parabola, and it's about 50 nanometers, I think, from the top to, right now, 50 angstroms.
So that's the extent from the parabola from the middle to the edge?
From the top of the parabola to the bottom.
And is there also roughness on
top of that? Yeah, there's.
The roughness is less significant than the top.
The roughness of that is, I don't remember. I have to go back and look at that. I don't remember. Excuse me? I think that that's just, it shouldn't be falling off faster. It's just bad data. It should have been taken off. I'm sorry. So next we look at, and this is the fast region, so y'all are asking about the another region. And you can see here, in the direction of propagation, the damage exceeds the length of the box. And so, and then in the y direction, we again see that the linear elasticity as the red line, and you can see a departure from linear elasticity around 10 nanometers from the crack tip. So if we look at the same thing, the porosity in the wake of the crack front, you can see here, this is the curve. If we do, again, a log-log plot, we see a departure, a 1 over R tendency about 25 to 30 nanometers, and that's about the length left to propagate in the system.
So, I guess what we would expect that the size of the process would be related to the stress, instantaneous stress applied to the crack tip.
Not yet. I need to look at the correlation between the stress and the pores opening up, and also the density, how the density may be fluctuating ahead of the crack tip. And that's why we went into looking at irreversible deformation, so that we could decide what techniques to look at ahead of the crack front to be able to determine where we're having plasticity and various different. Well, you're continuously pooling, so you're continuously adding energy to the system. Yeah, because this is a big system, and you can't. I mean, you can't. it's very. You have to continuously pull, or else it'll never fracture. And I was.
But you can still have question what the
system. Yeah. Right. Yeah, and we've asked those questions. I just haven't gotten a chance to go back and look at that kind of information. So this is a walk through at the crack front. So you're actually walking in the negative x direction, so the opposite direction that the crack is propagating. You turn and you walk parallel to the initial crack front. And so in here you can see there's strings keeping the two edges connected, the two free surfaces connected. So, and then just turn them. So the next thing we looked at was the fracture surfaces after the system was broken. So here is the simulation result. Here is an experimental result. You can see that the simulation, it looks like mountains and hills, and similarly that's seen in experiments. So we used the ZMAX method of looking at the fracture surfaces. So you have a window here, and you look at the maximum point minus the minimum point, and you average over all x's. And what you find is that this function is proportional to the window size to an exponent, where the exponent is called the roughest exponent of the fracture surfaces. And experiments, there's two commonly found exponents, 0.5 at small length scales and 0.8 at large length scale. And so here, the roughness exponent, here you see 0.44, which is close to 0.5. And then this is simulation. Experiments, the 0.5 is the universal exponent and the 0.8 is the universal exponent. Experiments only see, in glass specifically, only see the 0.8 because it's at the length scale is too large. They haven't gotten to the point where they can see this length scale, and simulations haven't gotten to the point where we can see their length scale. So, huh? Yeah, but it's not in glass. Most of them are in plexiglass or wood and. Okay. Yeah. I know it's true for a variety of materials. I didn't think it had. It may be. It may have been. To go back and look at the paper and see.
If I were to do the experiment, the cheapest, most.
Right. Well, right now we're looking at doing another. This simulation was started a while ago, and so now the computer systems have gotten bigger. So we're looking at doing a larger simulation and hopefully being able to see the larger roughness exponent. We were hoping to see it with this one, but we didn't succeed at doing that. Because it's around 100 nanometers. Yeah, it's the 0.7, 0.75, 0.8, it's the higher of the roughness exponent.
So that has been seen, but no one has seen the lower one.
People have seen 0.5 and 0.78 in MT, just not in class. I don't think.
So the difference is the relative potential, whereas the previous work would be.
It could be just a difference of potentials, because I think a difference in material that the potential is being applied to.
So this is, this parallel means, sorry, with X, this is.
This is in the direction of propagation. Is perpendicular to the direction of propagation. It was 0.446. Yeah, so it's somewhere around 0.5. So next we, since we have this damage ahead of the crack front, we've started looking at irreversible deformation in silica. Also, Saint-Gobain research is interested in densification under nano-indentation, and that's why I'm working with them on this project too. So some of the questions we're looking at answering is, what kind of plastic deformation is occurring in the wake of the crack tip? So in other words, what kind of structural changes are occurring in this, in the bonds? And once the free surface is formed, what kind of structural changes are in the free surfaces? And then also, how are the rings adjusting to this free surface? Because in the bulk, they're predominantly six-membered rings. And so what's going on the free surface? So one of the things we looked at was the densification versus time loading and unloading cycle. So you can see the densification I define as the change in volume divided by the total volume. And this is the rate, the curve.
Do you have to see what the stress strain curve is?
I had, and it turns out it's about, you get the Young's modulus to be a little low, because when I've always strained it, I've always pulled and never compressed, and it seems to be a little bit more stable in the compression.
But, I mean, in terms of saying, like, what you do?
No, I haven't done that.
So the stresses that you're stressing to here are.
This is densification. This is the rate at which this. I did several at different rates, and this is the rate here.
Your rate?
Compression. This is densification. This is a so your change. The volume is changing. I did shear. And shear, I have to, it's coming.
So that's the frequency of the compression.
The compression.
So it's time, so we know the total strain is the total compression. So you're doing it to a particular stress, to a particular pressure in the infrastructure, or to a particular compression?
To a particular volume, to a certain volume, and then releasing it, and then changing the volume again.
So each one of these is to a different volume.
It's densification, so I impose a volume and then I measure the.
So you go to pressures of 2 GPS? What is the pressure of the total?
40% as
So this is the pressure versus densification.
And that was just the loading.
That's the loading. That's all. That's only the loading.
So that you set.
Yeah, that was my that was a set point. So what I was going to say was, I look at if delta V over V is zero, then I turn around. I don't allow it to be extended from its initial. I only allow for densification. I don't allow for dilation. And then also I look if the pressure is approximately zero, then I turn it around too. So there's two different quantities I'm looking at to turn around to for the densification. This point up here is set. I set that point. So this is the pressure versus densification. So this is the whole figure. If you look at just the first 50 picoseconds, you'll find that the line just retraces itself. It goes back and forth, and it's just going over itself. And then you see the hysteresis forming because of it's beginning to have some irreversible deformation. Yes, I think I did do that, and it was about, it does the same thing. You see the same thing. Yeah, there's a hysteresis. So and when you look at the bulk modulus in this, you find that it's about 36, which is about there's a range in the bulk modulus, and that's one of the values that becomes the people at Tenkaman went and looked in one of their books, and that was one of the values that they had.
But how do you evaluate that? Are you looking at the average bulk of this line?
No, what I do is for the first 50 picoseconds, if you just look at it, it just goes back and forth. And then it starts doing that after this may not be the best way to show it. I need to improve the figure. I had it.
Drive it to 40 GPA, you go back to zero pressure, you are going to end up with something which is strongly densified, which is like 2.4 grams per centimeter.
Yeah, you'll see something.
10% hysteresis when you go back to you compress it to 40 GPA, and you come back to.
It's probably quite static.
Are you saying when experiment this is what should happen? It could be that the potential doesn't allow the sort of rebounding. Actually, 40 gigapascal, 40% densification only leaves about, I don't think it leaves 10% densification. I think it's smaller than that. I don't remember the. I have. Because we were looking at the results and they're about what they're expecting.
The bulk modulus was?
36. And these, I'm sorry.
No, I'm just trying to understand the equivalent. It's just, it's not the tip indentation. It's just compressing it.
It's just hydrostatic compression.
And the time scale that you hold it with a given pressure is only 1 or 2 picoseconds, right?
Right.
So it's not a lot of time.
So the surprising thing seems that the hysteresis is so small that you end up coming back almost exactly to the place you started out at. Is that how it interprets the picture?
It doesn't come back exactly. It's kind of deceiving because all the data is put here, so you would have to look at the last one.
Because if you look at the previous one, she's turning around at zero pressure.
Okay.
So there's a few percent residual strain.
Yeah. It's about.
Wouldn't have time to rearrange things like the field. So the kind of damage you might expect over longer time.
Well, you do see some you do see the densification, and you do see structural changes. Yeah, and I did it at, I mean, simulations are still very limited by time, so we do have to take that into consideration. But I did it at lower strain rates, and I find about the same things. Mm-hmm. So the next thing I looked at was the maximum densification versus the minimum densification. So when I say maximum densification, I look at that point there, and minimum densification is this point here. And you can see there's a departure from, the system doesn't return to minimum densification of zero between 20 and 30, about 25, and they're expecting it to be about 27, is what the people from San Lugabas were saying. This is a fairly rough curve. I'm doing a bigger system of 100,000 atoms with 12 systems, and I'm going to get some statistics from that to be able to get a better curve here and figure out the best rate.
The
rate
is what?
Huh?
How fast is the ground
It's 0.6 in meters per second.
How many nanometers?
Yeah. It's kind of high. Yeah.
And this thing is like a shuttle moving at 10 kilometers a second or something, smashing into this.
Right.
So you might think it's you're doing an equivalent experiment with a laser pulse or something hitting you.
No, I'm going to. This one's very small. I'm doing a larger simulation right now. It's 42 angstroms. So the next thing I looked at was the minimum densification at this point versus the maximum pressure there, and we find that this is about 15 gigapascals, somewhere around 15 gigapascals, and that's what's expected in experiments, the departure from minimum densification of being zero.
Could you explain how you do your cycle? I mean, when you compress you are scaling your floating rates.
Yeah, I'm scaling all the coordinates.
Until you reach some prescribed classification.
Right.
So then when you expand until you reach zero pressure?
Either zero pressure or zero densification.
In the plot we saw it was zero pressure, the bottom of each, the curve with the oscillation of it.
Yeah.
That one, yes.
So
the bottom of each oscillation is zero pressure.
I said I can only go back to my initial volume. I don't want to pull on the system. I just want to densify. I don't want to dilate.
So the last graph you were showing, the densification shows essentially the irreversible.
Right. Right. Yeah. The next thing I looked at was the bond length, and for the SIO bond length, you don't see much difference. They're about the same. This is the residual densification after 30% densification, and this is the residual densification after 40% densification. And the SI bond length under densification, you can see that there's still not much change. And similarly, the oxygen-oxygen, there's not much change. But when we look at the static structure factor, if we look at the first peak in the static structure factor, this one here, we see that there's a difference in the... They're not all laying on top of one another. The red one's pretty much on top of the blue, but the purple one, which is after 2.3% residual densification, they're not the same. So this implies that the ring structure is changing in this, that we're getting a change in the ring structure, so the mid-range order. I need to look at the ring structure exactly how they're changing, but this is a sign that they should be changing. I hadn't looked at that. That's what I was thinking that it was.
Yeah, so but it's a relatively modest. Just maybe it's not very dramatic. We have to look at the reason. And then it's really dramatic that we all have to
silicon, oxygen, silicon, but you may, for example, oxygen, silicon might be much less modified than the other.
Well, there's actually a matter of modified, but that was the real
space. But in the principal space here, you don't see much, you see, this is where you see the major change in the different curves. That's why we were believing that it was most probably the ring structure difference. But it may be something like you said, where it's just a region. And I hadn't thought about that, so I'll have to go back and look at that. So the next thing I looked at was stress versus shear. So this is the stress and the strain. And the shear modulus in this region is about 26.4, and it's expected experimentally to be about 26. So that's pretty good. This is Morse and Evans. Yeah. So you can see there's a peak about 15. percent strain, and that's about where they were expecting that the experimentalists expect that there'll be a change, and it starts to flow. And it's very gentle. It seems high.
Well, for most people,
compared to like.
Which one's high? I'm sorry.
The yield stress.
Actually, it's expected experimentally to be about 3.5. So this is a little lower than what's expected experimentally.
But the percentage strain is.
The percentage strain is, but it's expected to be about 15% experimentally. Because the yield. I'm sorry. Yeah.
But experimentally, I thought that, so you see plasticity in glass.
Yeah, but I mean, so she's looking at a very, very tiny sample in periodic boundary conditions, and so since there is no surface and there are no flaws, you're sort of artificially suppressing the fracture mechanism.
Okay, so this is because there is no fracture mechanism that you can
see
that. You do not see that.
Right.
1% for the. Okay.
And this is not cyclic, this is just continuous.
This is continuous.
But I think this is interesting in the sense that if you're looking at the crack tip, right, and you want to know what is the response of the material in the region of the crack tip, if you know the ultimate stress at which you start getting yield, you can use that to with the externally applied stress to estimate the size of the plastic.
I was under the impression experimentally they were expecting it about 15%. The yield point. This.
I guess when you told us that the yield stress was actually a big thing, if you just take the modulus, which is about right, and the higher yield stress, that would suggest that you're going to have a bigger strain.
Wait, the shear modulus is about the same.
Right, and you told us that the yield stress from experiments is higher than.
Yeah.
So you take the modulus and the yield stress, and you can get a prediction for the strain of yield, and it's not even higher. Thank you. As usual, though, most systems.
Excuse me? 300 degrees Kelvin. But you take it in that you take that into consideration, and you still have some interesting results. That even though this is a high rate, we still have some.
Right. Well, we're just trying to understand whether, given the simple polymer drop, you see that peak position shift a higher percentage strain as a function of cure rate, like a fairly dramatic shift in the amount of cure rate.
Okay.
And then you see it drop back around 7% when you're in the limit of going to the last 5 days forward.
Okay.
Maybe play into the point that they can't remember the strain rates and see.
That's what I'm working on doing now. But I hadn't seen much difference, to be honest, so far. So. The next thing I looked at was a fabric tensor, and this is commonly used in granular materials and also in studies of bones and how the bones or touch point. So N hat is a vector between the SI and O bond, and it's just a unit vector. You take the alpha components and the beta components of all the SIO bonds, for example, and sum them up, divide by the number of bonds, and you get the element alpha beta of the fabric tensor. You find the eigenvalues of the fabric tensor, and if they're one-third, 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 they're perfectly isotropic. If they deviate from that one-third, 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 they're anisotropic. So, for example, I'm just going to show one result so far. I have the SI-SI, the one I'm looking at, the n-hat between the SI-SI bond. And you can see here the black is the first eigenvalue, the red is the second eigenvalue, and the green is the third eigenvalue. So you can see the black, it decreases a little, but then it does some jumping in this region, and it starts to increase. And so this, from what I understand, is elongating, like an elongation in the x direction. I think so, and you see a contraction in the y direction. So I'm steering in the xy direction, so you see a contraction in the y.
What makes it eigenvalue 1 or 2?
The direction. So, well,
is the eigenvalue the closest to being along some direction calling that 1?
Well, whenever I...
So it should be back and forth.
So you have your...
The direction of the eigenvalue.
Huh?
Switching back and forth, really something real, or is it just an artifact of what order the eigenvalues are returned by the program?
That I'm still trying to figure out. This is the way that they're returned by the program, right? But so I'm trying to figure out if it's actually something intrinsic in it, or if it's something... what exactly is going on, so I'm not sure, but
you'd want to look at the dot product of the test of eigenvalue,
right? You're seeing that, you could say, whenever the system starts to flow, you can see the eigenvalues of these start to flow. They remain constant for the SI-SI.
So the geometry here is you're doing uniaxial compression.
No, this is shearing. This is shearing.
And the other two directions, so this is like simple shear?
This is shear in the XY plane. And then the Z component is remaining constant. That's why I understood that the green is... Yes. So I was understanding that the X was elongating. It was, since I'm shearing in the X direction, it would be elongating in the X direction, and the eigenvalue would maybe be compressing in the a little bit.
The strain is composed of both an elastic part and a plastic part. And only the elastic part would show up as stretching of the bonds.
But if you look at 15% of the plasticity, so up to 15% is presumably an affine displacement, and an affine displacement to be exactly like that.
Right, so what I'm wondering is if you call it the stress, would it just be essentially something linear or something simple? You know, because measuring something about the stretching of the bonds directly, which is really
interesting. In other systems that I've looked at similar things, what happens is you get an affine displacement up to some point that gives you this, and then it starts to yield, and then you no longer accumulate. So you see this sort of saturation in the green of oil.
Mm-hmm.
So it may, my guess is, but that's exactly what the expression is. Qualitatively, it's different. Yeah, we'll discuss a lot.
Wouldn't you say something kind of fun? If the yield is not due to rearrangement among the different molecules, but kind of as a change in the molecule itself.
Well, that's why it
would seem like it's, I mean, the deformation is usually happening by defects, rebonding.
Right, but this is a single,
right.
One is a single molecule telling that it's, on average, it's done out. The molecules themselves are breaking down.
Stretching, yeah, that's what I heard.
You just drew a bunch of lines at random on rubber sheets, and you drew the rubber sheets, you see the window parts of the curve. But, you know, by doing this, you take an isotropic distribution and you make it an isotropic by curing and applying the definition.
Right.
So,
that's what gives you the. But at some stage, you think of damage.
Well,
so
the damage and the damage
is out, I think.
Because that box at some point, it can't accumulate any more thermal acid in it. So you can just randomize it. And,
mm-hmm. Oh, okay. This is as far as the molecule is going to take.
That's
15%.
So,
and then after that,
right.
The
rearrangement serves.
The fabric goes.
Yeah.
So it should be just using an alkaline displacement model, you should be able to get the flows that are needed.
Okay.
If they don't agree, then that
okay. In conclusion, so I saw that the that crack propagation involves the growth and coalescence of pores, and this has been confirmed by FM studies, and then simulation experiments can define a damage zone in glass by examining the departure from linear elasticity, and we found the simulations found the smaller roughness exponent of 0.5. And then we're seeing some irreversible deformation and densification and shear. So what I'm looking at doing now is continuing the study of this plasticity and doing the bigger simulations so I can get better statistics on the cyclic loading and unloading and also on the shear. And then also what we're going to do is load a sample and then shear it and see what happens. So shearing under densification. And next, once we have these results, the group at Saint-Gobain want to figure out what's the most relevant information for their mesoscopic model, and they're going to put it into their mesoscopic model. Also, right now, I'm currently involved in the study of 3D effects of damage in experiments. So what that is once you have the postmodern fracture surfaces, they you can slide them across each other and look at the Fresta method and see that pores are opening up, and we're looking at doing that in 3D. It's always been done in 2D so far. And finally, I want to do nano indentation to see if, and because I have the 110 million atom system, and I think it would be great to do nano indentation in it. Thank you for your attention.